She's to sick bay. The doctor should look at it as soon as possible.
It is the way in which we propagate our species. Please demonstrate how this is accomplished.
So, what's next?
Hi, and welcome to Casual Trek, a Star Trek recap and ranking podcast brought to you by Nerd and Ty and the Gorn Digestive Pod Skin Cleanse. Burn off all stray chemicals, oxidants, bacteria, and flesh. Your skeleton has never looked so good.
Okay, stop. I want you to retake that. But when you do, when you say flesh, do you remember how you said flesh when you were talking about flesh in 2000 AD? So... go with that.
Wow.
Sorry.
That's all right. Hi, and welcome to Casual Trek, a Star Trek recap and ranking podcast brought to you by Nerd and Ty and the Gorn Digestive Pod Skin Cleanse. Burn off all stray chemicals, oxidants, bacteria, and flesh. Your skeleton will be gleaming by the end of it.
In the green corner, it's the researcher of ruptures, the exterminator, Charlie Hairless Effridge Nunn, an alien fan whose signature move is the facehugger. It'll get uncomfortably close, like Friday night at the Foundry.
In the gold corner, it's the grocer of gross bodily harm, Miles Reed-Lobato, a Blake 7 fan whose signature move is screaming, "No, really, Blake 7's really good, you guys," as he jumps off of the top rope. Each episode, we watch three different stories from three different Star Trek shows and fight them. And this time, we're fighting a bunch of lizardy bastards. Yes, yes, it's the Gorn. So, Miles, just to chill out after that, what non-Star Trek thing have you been enjoying since we last spoke?
Okay, Charlie, quick question. Yeah. As an Englishman, do you like spending time with a whole bunch of family members in one location?
I'd say yes and no. Like, my family are brilliantly odd, and it's always nice, but I also always feel like I'm the feral offshoot with it all.
Okay, well, here in America, they like to actually have, like, yearly family reunions, which, wow, you know, I find sick and against God. And I attended my wife Rihanna's yearly family reunion of the Fisher side of the family, which is usually basically 30-odd people gathering together in a location. So I went with her to this. I can't remember how much of the implied family difficulties I have been mentioned in the podcast. So we both went in anticipating a fight with particular family members, which thankfully didn't happen.
Hey.
It took place at this fantastic, very large lake house by this beautiful lake. I was told it would be a cabin. And admittedly, when they say cabin in Midwest America, and especially in Wisconsin, I was expecting something a bit more like the Leatherface house from Texas Chainsaw Massacre, fair, or the house where they filmed Night of the Living Dead. But no, a lovely place. The lake was beautiful. I did get overwhelmed by so many people very quickly, but everyone was lovely. After I kind of stopped hyperventilating into a paper bag in the bathroom, I did have a good time. I didn't stay overnight. Thankfully, I was able to get a lift back home from some friends who had driven up to the town nearby to begin with, so I made it a day thing, Rihanna made it a weekend thing, but it was still a really good time.
Excellent. That's really good to hear, 'cause yeah, I know it was something where there was a lot of trepidation.
Yes.
So yeah, neat.
And Charlie, what non-Star Trek thing have you been enjoying, you big monkey?
Well, big ape, more like. Because, yeah, I've been playing Donkey Kong Bonanza, which is a ludicrous game by the people that made Mario Odyssey. And it feels like that. You are Donkey Kong, the titular ape, who is going into a kind of hollow earth, level by level, each of which is so huge you can see a sky in it, despite punching your way down towards the center of the earth with Pauline, the original Donkey Kong's kidnapping victim, who is somehow a child here. I've no idea if it will be addressed or if they even care, but it doesn't matter. She seems semi-feral and good at singing. And yeah, it's a game where three of the four face buttons are punch. Just punch up, punch down, and general punch. And the levels are extremely destroyable, which it makes it very compulsive. And with the Mario Odyssey style, there are banandium gems, something like that. Giant gem bananas all over the place. So you'll just punch through the ground and go, oh, a banana, and whack it. And hey, it's a banana. There is a slightly disturbing part of it, though, which is the abilities you get from the giant elders of each main sub-level, all of whom somehow, for some reason, are aspiring DJs, as well as elder gods. It's very strange, but they will teach you how to do a bonanza into a different type of animal. The first one's an ape, so you are kind of double ape and even better at hitting. The second one is an ostrich, so suddenly you are a giant muscled ostrich who can flap a bit before gravity takes its course. And then the third one is a zebra, where suddenly you are a cross between a giant gorilla and a zebra that's on its hind legs, hooves for hands, huge muscles like a Liefeld character. You are like those disturbing Ren and Stimpy characters, like the massively muscled ones of those. It's disturbing, but it's been very good fun.
Rihanna picked it up a few weeks ago. I've only seen her play it a little bit. It looks incredibly fun, especially the fact that you can smash everything.
Oh, it's so cathartic, you know, and everyone seems to love it. You know, you break someone's home down into rubble. They're like, wow, that's really impressive. So yeah, thanks. Yeah. Thanks. Good. I'm glad you acknowledge that. So yeah, but we're not talking about leveling structures. Instead, we're going to talk about some rocks and some lizards, starting with a classic episode, if only because my only experience of it until now has been through Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey. Why, yes, it's Star Trek, the original series, season 1, episode 19, titled Arena. It aired on the 19th of January, 1967. Teleplay by Gene L. Kuhn, story by Frederick Brown, and directed by Joseph Pevney. The UK number one hit was Green Green Grass of Home by Tom Jones, and the US had I'm a Believer by The Monkees. And I saw the video for Green Green Grass of Home, and it feels weird seeing a young Tom Jones. In my mind, he is just eternally kind of old man from that video of the Cardigans or Mars Attacks.
Oh, it's always Mars Attacks for me because, you know, Mars Attacks, there are many, many fun things about that film, one of which is Tom Jones playing Tom Jones.
Yeah.
And Monkees, I'm a Believer, it's a classic.
It is. If I saw a weird HD upscaled version, which was disturbing, it was horror.
That feels wrong somehow.
It looked painted. And yeah, Emma was there watching it with me. It was like, they look even more plastic than usual. Yeah. And then I got into a weird conversation about Chekhov's hair, because this is what Casual Trek's done to me now.
Yeah. Oh, that they put Chekhov in a Davy Jones wig.
Yeah.
Did you know that it's the Monkees Davy Jones that made David Bowie become David Bowie?
Because Jones.
Yeah.
Of course. Very nearly did a Hulk Hogan voice at the start of this, and I'm pleased I didn't. Long may he burn.
I admit, I always have a soft spot for the Monkees because I really enjoyed the TV show when it got repeated on Channel 4 in the 90s.
Yeah, I vaguely remember enjoying it, but yeah.
And also, a good chunk of their songs are actually pretty good.
Yeah.
Unlike a lot of, like, clearly manufactured boy bands, they actually went for talent when they created the Monkees.
Oh, you wouldn't see its like again.
No, well, you know, but there is no party like an S Club party.
And on that note, Miles, you have 5 minutes for this S Club party. Starting now.
The Enterprise has been invited to the planet of Cestus III to have dinner with the Commodore. Great! He also wants Kirk to bring all his tactical staff. Bit of a red flag, but Bones fobs off Spock's concerns, and Kirk, Spock, Bones, and three others beam down to a devastated colony. The landing party is attacked by unseen assailants, and the Enterprise can't beam them back because they're also being attacked by an unidentified ship, Sulu commanding the ship in Kirk's absence. With explosions booming all around them, several of the landing party are killed, a single survivor is found, and Kirk is able to fight off the unseen attackers with a grenade and space mortar. Back on the ship, the survivor they found mentioned that the attack was sudden and without warning, and that the message inviting Kirk had actually been transmitted by their unknown assailants. Kirk wants to track down the ship, the alien ship, and destroy it, worried that letting the ship escape might be a prelude to an invasion if the aliens sense weakness in the Federation. The Enterprise gives chase. Spock doesn't think they should destroy the ship, just chase it off. But Kirk comments that since the Enterprise is the only ship out here, they're the de facto police and they need to uphold the space law since a space crime was space committed. Passing an uncharted solar system, the Enterprise is space scanned, but not by the alien ship, but by a third party based in that solar system. The alien ship suddenly stops moving and Kirk readies the Enterprise to attack, but as they get within firing range of the alien ship, the Enterprise immediately drops out of warp and into sublight, just like the alien ship. The life systems are working perfectly, but there's no energy to either the weapons or the engines. They're being held in place by a power that Spock cannot identify. A swirly pattern on lights appear on the view screen, and a voice proclaiming itself as a Metrone, and that the violence that they were planning is unpermissible in this territory. Since the human capacity for violence is seen as inherited, the Metrones will sort the problem out for them. Both Kirk and the Gorn captain, the Metrone mentioning that's what the alien is called, are going to be sent to a planet which will and have to fight it out amongst themselves. The planet will be prepared with materials and weapons needed to help them. Whoever wins will be allowed to leave, and whoever loses, they and their ship will be destroyed. They will be unable to communicate with their own ships, but they will be given little log devices which will allow them to note their progress for prosperity. The Metrone's test will be one of strength and ingenuity. Kirk tries to communicate with the Metrone, but is simply teleported off the bridge of the Enterprise and onto an arid wasteland with HOLY SHIT! There's a damn lizard monster 10 feet away from here! And also, that's the rock from Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey!
Yeah!
Kirk starts internally monologuing, mentioning how humans have a natural instinctive fear of reptiles, but he needs to remember that the Gorn captain is a starship captain, an intelligent, highly advanced, and incredibly sexual individual, if there's anything like Kirk. The Gorn breaks a tree branch and comes for Kirk. Kirk breaks off a tree branch of his own, but like, he's got a little twig, and the Gorn has like a proper bit of log. Kirk and the Gorn trade blows, but while the Gorn is slow moving, he takes all of Kirk's punches and kicks like a champ, and gets Kirk in a bear hold and nearly crushes the life out of Kirk until Kirk slaps him in with both ears. The Gorn knows when he's been tangoed. Kirk yeets a rock. It doesn't work, and the Gorn picks up a bigger rock and yeets it at Kirk with a mighty throw, but Kirk is able to kind of nimbly just kind of sprint away. Back on the bridge, Scotty tries to restore power to no effect. Kirk speaks into his log device given to him by the Metrones, unaware that he is transmitting directly to the Gorn. Kirk notes that there are no weapons as the Metrone promised. He knows he cannot fight the Gorn barehanded. McCoy asks Spock what he's going to do. All Spock can do is wait. There is nothing else he can do. Kirk continues looking for resources. Insert a Minecraft or a No Man's Sky joke here. He's finding numerous hardened diamonds, but he doesn't think they'll be of any use as a weapon. An incredible fortune, but he'll trade them all for a hand phaser or a good solid club. Watching the Gorn from a mountaintop, Kirk spies a giant boulder and decides to pull a Wile E. Coyote on the Gorn. Little tip, Jimmy, the Roadrunner always wins. The boulder seems to take out the Gorn, and Kirk scrambles down to check if he killed the Gorn.
Oh, look out for that boulder.
Oh!
It's 5 minutes. Yeah, careful. It's dangerous here. So, continue.
Kirk goes down to check to see if he killed the Gorn, but the Gorn gets back up quickly, pulling out a rudimentary knife. And in his attempt to flee, Kirk triggers a trap of the Gorn's own making, tangling him in a net of creepers and pinned by a large rock. The Gorn raises the knife for the kill. Cut commercial break. Kirk is able to scramble free because of the power of the commercial break and flees. Hiding, Kirk keeps searching for the supposed weapons, but all he keeps finding is these really hard pointy diamonds and a whole bunch of sulfur lying around. But where is the weapon? Spock and Bones still discuss what to do, but the Metron gets on the blower to tell the Enterprise that Kirk's losing. They should prepare for death. McCoy begs for mercy, but the Metrons believe them to be too primitive for the concept of mercy. But they will give the bridge crew a free pay-per-view of the fight. Spock immediately notices that Kirk has stumbled upon some potassium. It might be nothing. It might be everything. The Gorn communicates with Kirk via the lock device and tells Kirk that he is getting weary of the chase, since Kirk can move at about 3 miles an hour and the Gorn can move about half a mile an hour. And that after Kirk stops running, the Gorn be quick and merciful. To the Gorn, Cestus III was an invasion of their territory, and they took what they felt was needed action. McCoy wonders if the Gorn were just protecting themselves and the Federation were actually in the wrong, but Spock believes that that discussion might be better suited to diplomats. Finding some huge tubes of bamboo-like tree and some bit of creeper, an idea comes to Kirk, and he starts to work out a plan. Spock congratulates Kirk on the view screen that Kirk has figured it out. Gathering together the various resources, the potassium nitrate, sulfur, and some coal, with all these things, plus the diamonds, Kirk is able to create a rudimentary cannon using the various minerals to create gunpowder. As the Gorn walks towards Kirk at the speed of like half a Jason Voorhees, which is very slow, Kirk gets everything ready, using the lock device to spark a small fire to set off the cannon, and the Gorn is taken out. Kirk grabs the Gorn's knife, ready for the kill, but decides against killing the Gorn. Maybe the Gorn did think it was just protecting itself when they attacked the outpost, and tells the Metron to get their entertainment elsewhere. The Gorn disappears, and a luminous, glowing, boyish being appears before him. Oh great, it's another Gene Roddenberry star god. The Metron is surprised that Kirk showed mercy, despite all evidence of humanity's nature. Maybe humanity does show potential after all. The Metron offers to destroy the Gorn, but Kirk refuses. Perhaps humanity and the Gorn can settle a peaceful negotiation. The Metron returns Kirk to the Enterprise. Maybe in a few thousand years, humanity will have advanced itself enough to talk to the Metron on an equal level. Spock, get the fuck out of Kirk's chair, mate.
3 minutes and 7 seconds. Yeah, I admit, partway through my notes, which I've mislaid right now, it just goes, oh no, it's another cosmic being, isn't it? So fucking hell, space is rife with them. It's almost like they need some kind of god shock to get rid of some.
I am surprised the Metrons left Kirk some convenient rocks, considering Kirk's track record for taking out godlike beings with humble stone.
Yeah, you wouldn't want to get close to him when he's got one of those. Yeah, I knew this was going to be a classic one. Like, there is a lot of darkness here. And it feels a bit like the second location wasn't the most necessary of, like, have a chase through space. And then, you know, we're going from one external deserty shoot to another deserty shoot. But at least we got those cool rocks.
Yes, that's Vasquez rocks, which have appeared in many a film and TV show. Of course, we did mention Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey, a whole ton of Star Trek, a lot of Power Rangers, and the Muppet movie.
Nice. Oh, is that the old Muppet movie?
That's the 1979 Muppet movie. And of course, Galaxy Quest, which one day we will get to on this show.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yes, apparently they did have to actually add some rocks to it to disguise the houses in the distance for this, which I think the version I saw had actually edited them out anyway. Yeah, so that was cool.
I think this is one of those classic kind of Trek episodes, because, like, you know, it's one of those iconic images of, like, Kirk versus the Gorn.
Yeah, like, the fight was fine, and, you know, it took apparently 4 people to be the Gorn. Like, 2 in the body, 1 just for one just for close-ups, and then one is for voice of Vigorn.
I mean, given how heavy that suit looks and how hot those rocks probably get, I get it. I see it.
Definitely. Yeah, and I like that even though he was portrayed as some kind of lizardy monster, the Gorn captain was still kind of smart with it.
Yeah.
Like Kirk just runs into a trap pretty swiftly. Admittedly, the way they present it, and this will be an issue even in 2025, it still feels like, okay, you've presented this relentless killer, and you're like, well, maybe there'll be some peace. Maybe something can be done about this in a peaceful fashion. So yeah, not if he's still massacring, you know?
Yeah.
Like, that's not a good look. And sometimes we get some species where it's like, oh shit, yeah, that was a miscommunication. There are problems that have gone on and death ensue. But yeah, this feels a lot more violent than those.
Yeah, at the same time, we only just see a point of view. And which, you know, Bones brings it up and Spock's like, that's kind of more for the diplomats to sort out. I feel when we get to the later two episodes we're discussing, I feel like those episodes make a much more blatant opinion on what actually probably went on at Cestus 3. But that's for talking about that. That's for later.
Yes. Remember when folks went out to sets? Well, to like the middle of nowhere for things. Like, it's, I like this kind of thing. Like, a lot of the time in TNG you get, oh yeah, we've got some gardens or, you know, some old building that we're shooting outside of. And occasionally Strange New Worlds go like, look, they're back in time in Canada. But that sense of, we've driven out to some inhospitable rocks. These aren't great, but we're going to film there.
It's why it's always great when Doctor Who shoots at a gravel quarry. I mean, okay, you kind of laugh, but at the same time, it looks a lot more impressive than just like an alien planet set usually does on a BBC budget.
Yeah, yeah. Or even these days, like, there were, because I've started watching season 3 of Strange New Worlds. Episode 2 has a few shots where you can tell they've got one of those around kind of like most of a circle sort of
green screen,
like LCD set green screen type things of like, we're animating a background on that. So yeah, yeah, you could kind of, you see it in so many films now as well of like, oh yeah, the way that everyone's moving, they are just on a soundstage where you've got this kind of screen. And here you've got all sorts of fun shots, like Joseph Pevney, we've seen his work before, and he's good at giving us a Star Trek. But yeah, I don't know, there's something quite appealing about it. And I know in DS9, in that Bajor trilogy we did, the kind of rocky place that was used there was terrible, but they hated it, or at least the actors did. And the people making it loved it so much they kept going back there. It's like, oh no, people are ill and dehydrated. This is inhospitable. But at least, you know, Vasquez Rocks is evidently popular enough to have been used in a ton of things.
Yeah.
And one thing I found out with looking up the details for this is where William Shatner got his tinnitus, thanks to all the bombing at the start.
Oh God, there are some really close explosions.
Yeah. Yeah, again, it looks kind of real. It's not good. But yeah. Like, DeForest Kelly also got tinnitus from it. But the reason I know Shatner had it was because his namesake, Kirk, on Gilmore Girls mentions being a fellow tinnitus sufferer. As am I. But yes. So yeah, it's a fun fact, but I guess not for Shatner.
Not for Shatner, but like, it looks good on screen. As, you know, there's running around like there's a nice tracking shot as fucking explosions are going off everywhere. At one point, either Shatner or his stunt double is catapulted through the air.
Yes. Yeah. That was cool. And making the mortar, it was a fun moment of crafting a thing like that. Like, in Scouts, we had to make a catapult to launch a shoe. And we were dragged out to Stanmer Park, I think it was, to do that. It never got anywhere near as good as what they did. So
no.
I'll give them the credit for that.
They actually, TV show Mythbusters, they actually tried to replicate Kirk's bamboo cannon to see if it would actually work.
Oh, yeah.
It doesn't.
Oh.
The trunk blows up and would have killed Shatner. But, you know, it's TV.
Yeah, and it's good that they didn't at least make it real, I guess. Because back in 1967, I could see them going, well... Yeah, yep. Sure. There weren't as many checks on health and safety then.
I loved how just the sulfur looks like it's disgusted mustard powder everywhere.
Mmm.
Like, mustard, all right, okay. That's some salt. There's some good Shatner in this one.
Definitely. This is season one Shatner, so he's giving it his all. You know, this isn't season three or, God help us, movies Shatner.
Yeah, I feel like I really want to bring up, they did this exact same plot in a episode of Blake 7.
I see. I wondered why you were, announcing being a Blake 7 fan this time.
Although it wasn't in a quarry, I think it was in a forest somewhere. And it's Blake, of course, and the Federation bad guy who is chasing Blake at this point in the show. And you have the other characters on, like, the spaceship watching, like in Star Trek. And at one point, Avon just goes, right, I'm going to bed. Blake is in one tree, Travis is in another tree. Unless they're going to be throwing nuts at each other all night, there's no point in my staying awake. Which, I kind of wish there was a point in this episode when McCoy is just like, I'm going to go off for a drink, Spock. Just tell me if anything happens.
Yeah, I mean, that probably happened. Yeah, I was actually just finishing some 2000 ADs from 1984. And there's a story from Rogue Trooper where he's trapped in a field of carnivorous sugarcane. And
Because it's Rogue Trooper.
Yeah, yeah, and there's a Nort there who's dressed in, like, Roman centurion kind of armor and is a bit of a dick, and they're trying to not die at the hands of this stuff, and both get through it. And when Rogue finds out, oh no, it's after human DNA, and you're not as human as this guy, so you're probably fine. It's like, no, I'm going to stand with him, going to get him out of here. And of course it ends with the Nort betraying him.
Of course.
In the moment they're on the other side.
Yeah.
And getting shot and killed, as is the way. But yeah, again, this kind of, yeah, we are both skilled combatants trying to deal with each other.
I think the original story idea is actually a short story that they just adapted.
Because
okay. I think they, I remember that they did this in an Outer Limits.
Oh.
Which is, you know, you have like, you know, we'll have a human fight an alien and let's human him fight.
Yeah. Of course, in TNG, it would be a whole other matter and end up with Darmok instead.
Yeah. Do you think this inspired the final battle in the Dark Phoenix saga, given how much of a Trek nerd Claremont is?
I don't know. Possibly not. This is a fine one-on-one kind of thing, but in that you've got a ton of folks all fighting. And of course, the knockoff legion of superheroes, the Imperial Guard, showing up, kind of initially getting their asses handed to them, but of course, defeating the X-Men, who are a bunch of plucky youths.
Okay, this is... Frederick Brown did write a short story called Arena, which was published in the June 1944 issue of Astounding Science Fiction. Going over the summary in Wikipedia, he doesn't spare the bad guy, he just kills it. With a knife.
Yeah, I mean, that's not very Star Trek, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. The 1967, according to this, to avoid legal problems, they agreed that Brown would receive payment and a story credit.
Yeah.
I guess they were very similar. I know there was an Outer Limit, like a classic Outer Limits, which is a really good show.
Yeah, never seen the old Outer Limits, just the, like, 90s.
The 90s one, which is a lot sexier.
Yeah.
No, the original 60s Outer Limits is a lot of fun. It's a bit more avant-garde than the zone, which was coming out at the same time. It looks a lot better, and clearly has a bit more money. Fun and Games from season one, which, not one I go back to.
Okay.
Oh, some of the props from it we'll reuse in The Cage, actually.
Oh.
Oh! You know, in The Cage, when Pike is strangling the Talosian, and it turns this, like, a very beast creature?
Oh, yeah.
That's from that episode of The Outer Limits. So there is a connection. I didn't just go on a tangent.
I mean, you know, yeah, it feels like a good fun episode, but yeah. I guess we should talk about where we're putting it on our list of fun and not so fun episodes, because we've got a big list of best to worst Star Treks, which stands at 172 entries. It starts strong with Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, and then number 100 is Discoveries Through the Valley of Shadows, and down at the very bottom is, of course, Star Trek : Section 31, where it will probably remain at least until we do Star Trek Into Darkness, and then maybe it'll have a contender.
I actually do like Star Trek Into Darkness.
You monster.
I like half of it.
Mm.
I like half of it. I like anytime Peter Weller gets work.
Yeah, fair. You know, need to get paid. So, where does Arena stand on this whole list?
Man, let's see.
As far as confronting alien, like alien captains on planets, I think Darmok at number 10 is better.
I think they're both equally iconic in their own way. Mm.
Yes.
I feel like Kirk fighting the Gorn at Vasquez Rocks is like one of those iconic kind of classic Trek kind of moments.
Definitely. Would you say that it's still somewhere in the top Treks? It's like looking at, what, number 29, we've got Amok Time, which is another very iconic episode where Spock has his periodic mating season and must fight Kirk because of it.
Oh, God. I think in some ways this is slightly better because yeah. It's the fight itself does feel a bit more visceral, whereas there is kind of like as good as the Kirk Spock fight in Amok Time, complete with the music is. It is just kind of on a stage, and it's basically you and he fight, where there is kind of that great element of Kirk basically skipping through the mountains, stumbling across the various resources that he needs to build the weapon, and him going, but where the fuck is the weapon the Metron said there would be? There's just all this fucking sulfur here. I can't use sulfur for shit.
Look, he's in command, not sciences. Yeah, I think there's a bit more desperation in this, because you know with Kirk and Spock fighting, while it is fun, you know that the lads are going to be, you know, they'll still talk afterwards, they'll be fine.
Yeah, and this does end with Kirk doing a Starfleet, and yes. Not just ganking the Gorn.
Yeah, it's best that was where it ended. Although, it was the kind of thing where, especially at the start, of like, oh fuck, the Gorn have massacred these people. And they're like, well, not to get all space cops, but we're going to have to be space cops and just beat the shit out of some alien. So yeah, I'm pleased with how it ended. It
does end with Kirk going, maybe they were right. Maybe we were in the wrong. Because of that uncertainty, I can't just kill him.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. At 28, we've got Strange New Worlds' Subspace Rhapsody, with the cast singing through their problems.
Man, I wish the Gorn sang in this one.
Oh, that'd be great. What kind of music would the Gorn sing?
Barbershop.
Yes.
Something with a lot of harmony.
Oh, that'd be great. Yeah, a Gorn quartet.
The Gorn just starts singing Sweet Adeline. Or alternatively, Sweet Caroline, bum, ba, bum.
Oh, God. So many drunken nights.
It's not easy being green.
Yeah, that'd work as well. Okay, so, better or worse than Subspace Rhapsody? God, we got some good episodes up.
Okay. Better or worse than Unification?
Oh, God. Like, Unification's slower, given the multiple parts. I think it might just be a bit better. It's got some good Star Trekking in it.
Sorry, are you saying Unification is better?
Or I think it might just pip it.
All right, okay, because like Subspace Rhapsody is really good, but it's also really good for... Like, I think if you asked me to like make a list of episodes of Star Trek from best to worst. Or if someone said to me, hey, I want to try Star Trek, but I don't know where to start. Where should I start? I think I'll be more suited to go with Arena. Because even though Spock and McCoy are basically left sitting on the bridge eating popcorn and watching, and Spock's going, and Spock is armchair quarterbacking
for the entire fight.
He's like, yes, yes, he's starting to work it out. Yes, McCoy is just throwing popcorn at the view screen going, wrestle! Wrestle, damn you! And Spock, I'm sure at one point it cuts away and Spock's going, no! Get the sulfur, you fucking ugly Muppet!
Yeah, just like, well, if I was there, I'd have sold this already.
Oh god, if Spock was there, Spock would have made a rudimentary trebuchet out of all the bits he found.
Yeah. So yeah, how do you feel with Unification and Arena?
I mean, I have to agree, like, Unification, it's a slow burn, but like, there are so many great scenes, like, you know, it's great to see Patrick Stewart and Leonard Nimoy.
Yeah.
Or just the scene, it's Spock and Data, and Data asks Spock if he regrets, like, giving up his humanity to live a Vulcan. And just, like, the moment where he's like, I've wanted to be human my entire life. You have chosen to forego what I crave.
Well, yeah, and it's something where even if you're not a big Star Trek person, if you came to Unification with little knowledge and go, okay, this is Star Trek problem, Star Trek solution, and your big name people, your Picard, your Spock, like, people know who those guys are. Just from the acting chops alone, it's classic.
Or just the idea that Spock is trying to achieve peace between the two aspects of his races, not for any kind of conquest, but going, these people are naturally evolving to this point.
Yeah.
I have to stay and help them. Anywhere I can.
Yeah, yeah, it's his duty, the same way Picard would be with Romulans later on in the TV series Picard. Like, as ropey as it is.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, yeah, yeah, this may not necessarily fit the rules, but gonna have to do a Starfleet.
Because also, like, in Unification, like, it's also the perfect metaphor for Spock's entire journey, because Spock spends his entire life trying to find a balance between being half human and half Vulcan. And so how else is he going to spend his life? Helping the Romulans find a balance between being Romulan and being Vulcan.
Yeah.
At the same time, William Shatner fights a fucking lizard. That's like, no, that's number three on the list. That should go into top five alone. He tangos a lizard.
Oh, he does indeed. So that does put it at the 28th spot on the list. So, yeah, good. And for our next episode, we're actually covering a two-parter that was almost 2 years exactly apart. It is Strange New Worlds, Season 2, Episode 10, and Season 3, Episode 1, Hegemony, Parts 1 and 2. Part 1 aired on the 10th of August, 2023, written by Henry Alonso Myers and directed by Maya Villavello. And Part 2 aired on the 17th of July, 2025, written by Henry Alonso Myers and Davey Perez, and directed by Chris Fisher. Now, Part 1's number one hits are Dave and Central Cee with Sprinter, which we've covered it before. The lyrics seem more ludicrous each time that I see it. And Jason Aldean's Try That in a Small Town. And rather than talk about that, I was going to mention Gaye's hit record, Shum, which was a Ukrainian entry in Eurovision a few years ago. And it's very good fun. I'd say give it a listen. It sounds very weird and apocalyptic, witchy kind of tone to it, but also with a bit of a ravey, dancey kind of style. Like, yeah, welcome to the rave in apocalypse world kind of thing. And yeah, sometimes I like to put that on to kind of get in a bit of an energetic mood.
Okay.
And the hits from the 17th of July 2025 are MK featuring Crystal or Tristal with Dior, which fine. I find a lot of these kind of ones where it's all about brand just increasingly irksome. But yes, and then speaking of irksome, Alex Warren's Ordinary, which is not overtly kind of shit, like Try That in a Small Town, but is just quality-wise shit. So, Miles, what alternative track are you suggesting people listen to?
We finally did it. We finally get to talk about a Mountain Goat song.
And yeah!
And because I'm doing this for revenge, I went with Training Montage from their album Bleed Out.
It's such a fun track. And one of those ones where, again, if you want to get pumped up.
Oh, God, if you.
Going into a rough day at work, like, yeah.
Yeah.
It's. I'm a big fan of Beat the Champ. And it's one of the only things I know about wrestling is basically the stuff from Beat the Champ. But this feels like it could have gone alongside that album. But yeah. It's a
song I played a lot on the way to work when I've not particularly it's 6 a.m. I'm walking to work. This is one of those songs that gets me pumped up there with Gloria by Patti Smith, which if I am not pumped up at the end of that song, I am in a bad place emotionally.
So because we're covering a two-parter, like Hegemony, we are going to be handing this off relay-wise. Anyway, we are doing something similar to what we did with the Unification first two parts and handing this off in a kind of relay race. So, with that in mind, I will start us off with Hegemony Part 1. And hopefully, between us, we'll do this in 10 minutes. So, I'm starting the timer, as I guess I'll be the one ending it. So, let's go. Previously, some drama. Also, the Gorn are aliens from aliens now, but if they use technology. So, we're in a small Canadian, small Midwestern American town set. Apparently, this was affordable to them. It's a colony, apparently. And they chose this.
Charlie.
Yeah.
The Gorn tried it in a small town.
Oh. Anyway, they could... Oh. I'd have loved if they used the set of Stars Hollow from Gilmore Girls. Anyway, Battelle of the Kyogre is here with Nurse Chapel, who's vaccinating some kids. Get your kids vaccinated. She beams back up and Battelle gets a call from Pike. And oh, they're finally getting over both being captains in a relationship. But the feed goes all shaky and gets cut off. On the small Canadian town set, Battelle can't make calls, even up to the Kyogre. And then a random Starfleet shuttle crashes out of nowhere. And then a giant ship appears. Oh my god! The Enterprise gets an emergency call from Battelle. It's the Gorn! Admiral April says, oh, this is outside the Federation's territory, so we can't really interfere without causing a big incident. Pike says, yeah, but they are shits, though. So, after the call, he sets off to the Canadian small town set, only, oh my god, the Cayuga's been destroyed! Somehow, transports and scanners are being blocked from something on the surface, and a Gorn hunter ship is incoming as well. Could it get any worse? Probably. Starfleet call, and they've got an image from the Gorn. No, it's not a dick pic. Not this time. Or a cloaca pic? Or whatever they've got. It's a map of space showing their border at a big line. This planet with the Canadian small town set, it's on the other side, the Gorn side. Pike's still looking to cross it, though, and gets a lot of volunteers from the crew. He breaks out the Gorn box, a special chest full of forbidden weapons. You can tell, because they're black. So, they're going to do this. They're going to go down there. They're going to fake being some debris. Ortegas, after saying, no, I can't do it, goes, actually, what if we're debris? And that means she's volunteered herself for an away mission, something she's kind of wanted to be on for most of the season. And now that's happened, they can go off and do that. Meanwhile, on the ship, Spock and Una talk about how things weren't left well with Chapel, because, you know, Spock and Chapel were kind of looking like a thing and then not. And yeah, unfortunately, on scans for Kyoga's sick bay's a goner, so probably Nurse Chapel as well. Over on the small town, everything's on fire. There's a distant green beacon. It doesn't look good. It looks very Halo ODST. But there's a Gorn loose. Oh my god. Oh, it's skittering around. They shoot it. And oh, it's a youngling. And there's more. And they're working together. This is bad. Pike says maybe they need to figure out the Gorn more than just shoot them. But they are hiding in a room covered in a lot of blood. So that might belittle it slightly. They find a human life sign. They go to check it out. It's a trap. Thanks to a guy called Montgomery Scott, an engineer who's trying to trap some Gorn. He's from that shuttle what crashed at the very start, and he's figured out how to hide in plain sight. Scott takes them to the other survivors, and it's looking pretty rough. Good news, though, Patel's here, and she seems fine. Maybe. Bad news is, Chapel's not here. Scott has built a Gorn transponder to hide amongst them, and it's back in the shuttle, so they need to go and get it and then fly off. Also, the solar flares that his ship was studying, maybe they created some kind of feasting cycle in the Gorn. Uhura and Pelia have a chat on Enterprise about the interference being on the other side of the planet, and they need to break it somehow. Why not use the saucer section? It's not like anyone's alive on it. Over on the Kyoga, and Spock says only he can do this because of his Vulcan physiology, so he'll go and place rockets on it. Inside the Kyoga, oh dear, there's a lot of corpses, but also Nurse Chapel. She's alive and staggering around until she can get somewhere temporarily secure. She sees the Enterprise, starts signalling with a torch, but it runs out. Then she sees Spock flying about outside the ship, but he doesn't notice her. Pike, Patel and Scott are jumped by a Gorn youngling in the shuttle who jump scares them, hisses, looks at Patel and leaves. Ooh, that's weird. On the Kyoga, there's a Gorn who's LARPing alien isolation with Chapel. And then, after Spock's slow motion attaches a rocket, a Gorn attacks him before he could get the second one going. They have a fight, he drops his gun, and Chapel pops in to help. She shoots it, Spock smashes its space helmet, and we watch it writhe painfully and then die in space. Pike pushes Batel more, and she explains she's infected with a Gorn egg. She wants to sacrifice herself, but Pike's not keen on that. At this point, the saucer section hits the tower. Everyone can beam back to the Enterprise. Only Patel needs to get into sickbay, and when they try to beam up all the other humans from the surface, they're gone. They've been abducted by the Gorn. Oh no, and the Gorn start firing. Oh no, and April calls them and tells Pike, back off, you're a naughty boy. He's confronted with his worst enemy. Difficult decision making. To be continued.
And now the continuing. Attacked by Gorn fighters, Pike and the crew weigh their options. April demands that they rendezvous with the fleet, but he never said when. And so Pike wants to use that as the loophole, and unfortunately, the only real option is being retreat and rescue. Lieutenant Mitchell suggests that they use a dud torpedo carrying a special element that they can use to track the Gorn destroyer carrying their shipmates and the surviving colonists. Ramming the Gorn destroyer, the Enterprise succeeds in both launching the torpedoes and in escaping the rendezvous with the fleet. At sickbay, Nurse Chapel discovers that Captain Patel is allergic to the drugs needed to put her body in cryosleep, and so she cannot be put into stasis. Not great news, because she's going to be hatching Gorn babies in about a day. Spock is sent down to assist her with his scientific knowledge. I'm sure this won't be getting any more awkward than it already is. Meeting with the fleet, Pike discovers that the Federation isn't going to try and fight back against the Gorn, especially since they both haven't technically attacked the Federation. Since the planet is actually outside of Federation space, and they're still recovering from the Klingon War from a few years ago. Pike's certain that the Gorn will see this as weakness and keep pushing further and further into actual Federation space. He manages to convince April that he'll try and find a way to stop the fighting under the guise of patrolling the ever-changing Gorn border. Meanwhile, what's the Arn up to? Oh, She and the others are in cocoons, being kept in storage to be digested as food for the Gorn, and maybe also to fuel the Gorn ship. Breaking out, she's able to rescue all the main characters, except for a few of Ortega's fingers, which either got dissolved in the cocoon or eaten by a very hungry Gorn. It's never really said. They find their weapons in a part of the chamber where undigestible materials are deposited. They found it in the poop, okay? The ship's poop. They don't have a plan of escape, but one thing's for sure. They're going to try and rescue all the surviving colonists. Meanwhile, Scotty's been having trouble getting his Gorn cloaking device to work on the bigger Enterprise. And Pelia, who turns out to have been his teacher at Starfleet Academy, is disappointed that he wasn't taking notes. Scotty pointing out that he was a little busy running for his life. Pelia tricks Scotty into thinking that they've run out of time, and Scotty just pops the machine together, lickety-split, and gets it working in seconds. It works, but Scotty is pissed at the deception and storms out of engineer. Okay, Les storms out more kind of angrily teenage flout. Kevin teenager flounces out of engineering. Dick move, Pelia. Spock and Chapel note that Patel's body has been altered by the Gorn eggs, and that removing them will be even more difficult than before. As they wait for the computer to work to computate the latest simulation, Spock apologizes to Chapel for his behavior and hopes that they can be friends when Chapel gets back from her 3-month study trip with Dr. Corby. The simulation is a failure, but Chapel has an idea. They can use Una's blood, which is genetically modified to fight off all infections, as a potential way to combat the changes the Gorn eggs have made. You see, this is ironic because when Una was put on trial for lying about being augmented back in Season 2, it was Captain Patel who led the prosecution against Una. Una and Uhura have a theory about the Gorn, that their biology is dictated by coronal mass ejections, ooh madam, and solar flares, and that the Gorn attacks have been following particular types of solar flares, and that different types of solar flares might trigger the Gorn into a hibernation cycle. Unfortunately, recent stellar activity is suggesting that the Gorn are in full-on invasion mode. The Enterprise follows a Gorn ship to a binary star system and watch.
Whoa! My feasting cycle has started.
Well, we'll get some fish and chips then.
Oh, there's a good idea. Okay, carry on.
The Enterprise follows a Gorn ship to a binary star system and watch as the Gorn ship flies close between the two stars and then blips out of existence. The radiation from the stars also creates a natural kind of holographic barrier that renders the Gorn homeworld invisible, just as the Gorn Armada pops out on a course of Federation space. On the destroyer, La'an and the others plan to steal the Gorn ship by accessing the mainframe in the hangar room, also hoping to get the transporter codes needed to save the colonists. The Enterprise pursues the Armada, their attempt to contact the Federation fleet being blocked by the Gorn. Chapel and Spock start operating on Patel, despite the very slim chance of success. Pike asks that they can use the Enterprise to create an artificial solar flare, which could potentially trigger an early hibernation cycle. Pelia and Scotty brainstorm an idea, but the best one they would have involves flying the Enterprise right between the binary stars and magnetically attracting enough stellar material, which if left to collect too long, will cause the Enterprise to explode. That's okay, says Pike, we'll just switch it off before then. In the operating theater, Spock has a new approach for treating the Gorn eggs in Patel. Instead of trying to remove the eggs and risk killing Patel, why don't they just feed the eggs to keep them from hatching and thus give them more time to work on the problem? La'an is able to access the Gorn mainframe. She's been having flashbacks to her brother who had been able to decipher the Gorn language before he died, and she is able to get the codes they need. The Gorn attack, and in the battle, Ortegas is clawed in the gut by an adult Gorn. Stealing the shuttle, Ortegas, who is heavily bleeding out, is able to fly them all to safety as the Enterprise begins their plan to create the artificial solar flare. It works! Yay! The Gorn start returning home to enter a hibernation cycle, although, since they have now just completely fucked up the natural cycle of the Gorn biology, won't the Gorn just die from not being prepared or fed enough for hibernation? I don't know. I'm not a biologist. The shuttle lands on the Enterprise, and La'an is able to get the Enterprise the codes to rescue all the surviving colonists. Yay! Ortegas is saved! Yay! But she'll be carrying trauma from her experiences. Look, it's Star Trek. They don't have the best track record of character trauma consistency. Looking at you, Picard, how many times did you finally get over your experience of being assimilated by the Borg? Pike wonders if he's essentially kicked the problem of the Gorn down the line for someone else to deal with, while also demanding that Spock, Scotty, and Uhura all receive severe concussions to make sure they don't remember any of this in a few years' time. Okay, I made that up, but that's definitely what I'm thinking is going to happen in the last episode of Strange New Worlds. But instead, he goes to Patel's bedside and starts to pray for her good health. Patel is okay, for the most part. The Gorn eggs are still inside her, but they still have each other and their love as the Enterprise heads back to Federation space. Okay, so Pike starting praying was weird, right?
Yeah, it was weird. Like, this is Star Trek. We fight for gods here. Yeah, Roddenberry wouldn't have approved, I'm sure. But yeah, it was an odd choice. Yeah, there were so many moments in this. I was thinking, oh, this is like a video game. Specifically, Halo ODST with the burning small town and having to stealthily move around it. And then any fucking flood level from a Halo for all the bits on the Gorn ship. Of like, yeah, there are a lot of... It's very fleshy, the ship. You know, a lot of chunks, a lot of bits. And then, of course, a convenient drop bit for putting all the guns, which feels like a bit of an oversight on the Gorn's part.
Yeah.
Could you not have ejected them into space?
Yeah, or just, like, thrown them in, like, a bin.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it was a bin, just a fleshy one. A fleshy bin would be very unpleasant.
Fleshy Bin is the name of my David Cronenberg tribute band.
That's a good name. Yeah, I like Scotty as well. Getting an actual Scott to be Scotty.
It's weird hearing Scotty actually sound like a Scotsman.
Yeah.
Like, it's just kind of like, no. Like, it's just odd. Because you're like, okay, James Doohan does a decent, like, he does an amount of Scottish accent. But it never has that just natural Scottish burr or just vernacular.
Yeah, it's not great, but it's like Claremontian phonetic dialogue in X-Men in the 70s and 80s, where you go like, this is not Irish, this is not Scottish, but in my mind it kind of reads like kind of an odd it but not it,
yeah,
kind of way. And yeah, so it goes with Scotty and Chekhov, really, which it's still jarring hearing Walter Koenig speak without the bad Russian, you know, even after all the years of seeing him as Bester.
Oh, Bester. What a fucker. What a dick.
But yeah, this guy being Scott, and I liked that it was Scott until Scotty when Pellier met him.
Yep.
And the relationship those two have is delightful.
It's like the moment she walks in and sees Scotty, Scotty's like, I'm fucked. I'm fucked.
Yeah. Yeah. Her whole thing of, yes, he's my best student with the worst grades. So yeah, you know everything you need to about Scotty, about their relationship, about everything there. Of like, oh fuck. Yeah, that was good fun. I still find the idea of the Gorn acting as they are in this weird, given the Gorn we've seen. Originally I was like, are they going to do an Enterprise? And like, they'll do something with the solar flare which will start a mutation that may take thousands of years, but they're going to start looking a bit more like a guy in a rubber suit.
I admit I have some problem with the Gorn. Again, like you said, in comparison to how they're portrayed in this series, as they're seen in TOS, in which they feel just too monstrous. Poor as an alien civilization. Like, I know I've spoken on this show about the differences between Star Trek aliens and Doctor Who aliens. Which is fundamentally, most Doctor Who alien races aren't like alien species or cultures. They're mostly monsters. They're like evil monsters for that kind of pulp nature of the show. Like, the Daleks didn't naturally evolve to be Daleks. They're radioactive racist mutants who have been genetically modified to be extra racist. And, like, whereas, say, the Ferengi or the even the Klingons at their most yellow peril with the full-on Fu Manchu tashes and everything in Errand of Mercy, we still get the sense that they are a culture and a race, and it was only through later on that they were subsequently developed. Like, even, say, the Romulans or the Cardassians, there are moments where you see quote-unquote good Cardassians, and you see bad Vulcans, you see bad Bajorans, you see plenty of bad human admirals. You see good and bad members of very different perspectives of all the various species, whereas the Gorn, as presented here, they're just monsters.
Yeah.
There's no sense of a culture. They are... Actually, I know what a good equivalent to them would be. Did you watch Firefly?
Yeah.
The Reavers.
Yeah.
Firefly, it's... where they're not a culture, they're just an unseen foreign horde.
Yeah, horde was what I was going to say with that. Yeah, it's that kind of, oh, this is all odd seeing that kind of, yeah, they are just, they may as well be animals. And that's fine. You can have a feasting bunch of animals, but then these guys have spaceships.
Yeah, these guys have a technology. They've
got helmets and some kind of language.
Yeah, and so... like even in Arena, you have Kirk going, although I feel naturally repellent of this creature because... humans have a natural hatred of reptiles. I have to remind myself that this is clearly a member of a highly advanced civilization who, even if he doesn't look like me, is clearly capable of the same drives and levels of intelligence as me. Whereas here, especially when they break out the Gorn box, they are just two steps away from... It's okay to kill them because they're monsters, right?
Yes, it's basically like zombies, you know? That kind of thing. Or, yeah, like, again, going back to Halo, like, whatever the lizardy guys are in that, which I say as someone that is a fan of the Halo series, has never bought one sober, I can't remember what the lizard guys are called.
Well, I think your best description was the Xenomorphs.
Yeah.
They're basically the Xenomorphs from Aliens, but like they have a technology.
Well, you get a few moments of Alien Isolation, you know, of exactly that kind of thing. Oh, this tail is hanging down slowly.
You had the Gorn trying to punch in the command codes on the Cayuga. I texted you, it's like the Gorn is just going 0001. 0002.
Yeah.
1, 1, 2, 3, 4. That's the same combination as my luggage.
I mean, is it that kind of thing where are we supposed to assume they're like crows or something where you go, these are animals, but they have developed tool use over time. So they kind of know, you know, like the weird horrific cunning of seagulls who, you know, in my area, you see some of them stopping by traffic lights as if somehow that stops and starts from going. And it's like, guys, you don't need to wait. But still, they do it.
Yeah. I don't know, because, like, the Gorn have been a recurring threat through Strange New Worlds. And yeah, from their first appearance, like, the immediate reaction from La'an, who was the only character who had met them, was basically, we need to fucking run and kill them because they will kill us.
Yeah, just like fucking pants-wetting horror.
Yeah, and honestly...
But, you know, you can have your monolithic enemy, but make them a people, and it's like...
You have it with the Borg, but again, the Borg aren't a culture. They are... They're a monster. Because they've been recreated and reprogrammed to be this consuming space locust. They're not a civilization. They are just like consume, assimilate, appropriate.
Yeah, I feel like we almost need to know more about them before going like, is this problematic, this whole cell slaughter? And like you were saying about, is this going to kill them? But then is their feasting cycle starting early going to cause problems for them down the line as well? Like, are they just fucked?
Yeah.
Because of this. Yeah.
It just seems a really odd... It's a take in Star Trek I don't particularly like, because it does feel like it's going against a lot of the ethos of Star Trek. Where, yeah, like, even in the most kind of jingoistically American the show gets, like in the 60s, it's still trying to present these opponents as people. Like, the Romulans are seen as a huge threat in Balance of Terror, but you still have the moments where it's the Romulan captain going, was this a good idea? And the Romulan captain and Kirk having a little kind of mind game where you have, which ends with the Romulan captain going, in a different time and place, we could have been friends. Or Kor, like, clearly wanting to be Kirk's big number one rival, but it doesn't work because Kirk is even Khan,
yeah,
who is presented as like Gene Hitler in Space Seed, gets to go to SETI Alpha 5, or is it SETI Alpha 6? And basically let to kind of chill. Even the most irredeemable villain in TOS is given some benefit of some capacity of humanity. Even Kodos in The Conscience of the King, who is presented as like one of the most terrible murderers of his time, when you encounter him in that episode, he's just a broken old man,
yeah,
who wants to escape the past, and the true monster is his daughter, who has been killing anyone who could identify him. And it's not the case of he is evil, like, it's that the evil has, the cycle has continued.
Yeah, and it's that thing of not everything needs to be solved by, hey, we hold hands at the end and skip, isn't this wonderful? But yeah, you got some problems with this. You maybe send it back, have another go at it, and then give it a try.
It's like I'd never actually watched enough of the Zindi arc of Enterprise, so
no.
I don't know how the Zindi get treated down the line of like the post 9/11 season of Enterprise. And I feel like a lot of this could have been solved if Strange New Worlds had done something incredibly controversial in this day and age in modern IP and just created a new race to be the new bad guys.
Maybe, yeah. Yeah, and it does make you wonder, okay, did Kirk just not read up about these guys?
Yeah, because you think the moment, like, the Matron mentions the Gorn, and it's not as if, like, okay, everyone kind of laughs in the fact that Spock apparently never mentioned his sister in TOS. But, like, Scotty, Uhura, and Spock are there on the ship, and clearly Scotty had a traumatic experience with the Gorn, given how he acts in this episode. And yeah, apparently at no point does Spock go, well, shit, it's a Gorn, don't fancy Kirk's chances.
Yeah. Start running a book against him. Like, oh shit, these guys haven't heard about it. Right. Tenor.
It's like, should we have mentioned the Gorn?
Yeah, I can't remember if there was something about the whole Gorn stuff being a bit on the down low.
I don't know.
During season two. I have a vague thought that that was the case, but I might be wrong.
I can't remember, because it's not a case of, like, in Discovery, where they basically have a moment where it's like, okay, it is against the law to talk about any of this. And it could be the case, it might be a case of they're keeping it on the down low not to scare Federation citizens. Whereas, like, you know, the military, the Starfleet military clearly knows that the Gorn is doing this.
Yeah. I mean, maybe with the whole kind of, oh yeah, their feasting cycle and dormancy and all that, might they have gone, oh yeah, actually, we messed up a bit here, so we're not going to advertise. That we may have encroached on their space. Like, we probably did.
And yeah, and like, also, just given the nature of the Gorn in Strange New Worlds, it just kind of dispenses any kind of the ambiguity that the Federation may have been in the wrong in setting up a base on Cessus III and Arena out the window, because I'm like, yeah, these guys are monsters. You can't trust whatever the hell they say. They're clearly the aggressors.
Yeah.
But, you know, you have to have your name recognition because, oh man, wasn't it really cool when Kirk fought the lizard monster in that one episode of Classic Trek? Let's just bring back the Gorn, where, you know, you could just say make up like a race of space arachnids, and it would, you know, who lay their eggs in their victims, and it would work probably better, because like then you don't have that baggage of having to have it like correspond with what has been presented before.
Yeah, maybe. Oh dear. Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. Like, this was, these episodes were well crafted. They were fine. But yeah, they just open up so many of these kind of questions. And it's where I'm quite pleased that Starfleet Academy is being set in the grimdark post the burn future, because we don't have to keep constantly going backwards. Think of Alien, seeing Noah Hawley talking about the alien Earth and going, yeah, we're going somewhere we haven't gone before the Alien movies. It's like, man, they're all before Alien these days.
They're all before Alien, and we saw what happened. Like, you know, if you're an Alien fan from like when the films were originally relevant, if you read the Dark Horse comics, you know what happens when the aliens reach Earth.
Yeah.
Everyone dies.
Yeah, I mean, he's a guy that did Fargo and Legion, so I'm definitely giving him some benefit of the doubt. But yeah, that whole thing of going, oh yeah, it's a bit, I don't know, it feels a little much constantly doing prologues or like prequels.
Yeah, I mean, I will be watching it because I may be talking about it on another podcast.
Oh.
You know, where else do I talk about other shit that's not Star Trek?
Yeah, fair.
It was good. The kind of notes with Best of Both Worlds were kind of difficult, were a bit kind of tough to ignore at times. Like, oh, we got, you know, they've been captured by the bad guys. We defeat the problem by just kind of switching them off and kicking the problem down the road to be sorted out
one day.
Yeah,
like, it's not like Arena sorts them out.
Yeah, like how did Ortegas lose those few fingers?
I mean, I assume it was the Gorn skin cleanse kind of thing, or like, yeah, I don't know. Maybe one of the Gorn just idly snacked on on Ortegas, going like, no one's going to notice. Just comp and then carry on. Yeah, yeah.
Pellia is still my favorite character in the show.
Oh, she's great.
I enjoyed it, but like, unfortunately, some of the problems I have are also problems I'm kind of getting with Strange New Worlds. Like, especially after like the last episode I watched before this was the episode where Spock gets turned into a human.
Oh yeah,
and there is that kind of implication that like the writers of Star Trek Strange New Worlds just think that all alien stuff is just like inherent genetic thing.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that was done with like malice or going, yes, all these people are all like that. It felt like more, you know, we can have some emotional beats and some sitcom shenanigans. Like, oh no, he has to meet the in-laws, but he's human. Ooh, what hijinks will ensue. But
and his in-law is played by an Indian actress, so it's gonna come off as really kind of uncomfortably racist, given those tropes. I watched Goodness Gracious Me back in the 90s.
Yeah, but I don't know. It's that thing of, I think there's just not as much thought or
no
remembering that. you know, Star Trek nerds are fundamentally broken, like all nerds, and as such are going to examine these things.
Yeah, and it's like, you know, Worf definitely, you know, like, yes, Spock and Worf very much play up the aspects of their culture, but they're also characters who are at a remove from their culture, and so they it always feels like it's a personal choice to big up, like, their home heritage.
Yeah. Well, yeah, with Worf, you've got the interesting oddness of going, well, thing is, though, it's not like he's actually... He didn't entirely go there. You know, he was raised by humans, but he's discovering and learning and, you know, doing what he can.
And just, like, full-on, like, trying to embrace, like, embrace a Klingon heritage, which, like, the rest of the Klingons have gone... Yeah, we subscribe to the newsletter, but we don't actually read it.
Yeah, yeah, and for a lot of his colleagues are going to be like, what is any of this? Like, we don't understand, we've been at war with this for ages, so what?
Yeah.
What is it? What are you doing, man? Because, yeah, they don't know.
Yeah, so I guess since we're talking about other Star Trek shows...
We should probably get ranked.
We should get in this on the big list.
Yeah, okay, God. So, it's that difficult middle point, I guess. What have we got further down here? Trying to see what other... Okay, I'm trying to remember where Genesis is. Genesis, 82. Again, you've got some nice body horror bits. You got Barclay becoming a spider, always fun. Yeah, that's 82. Do you reckon this is better or worse?
Because Worf kills and eats a guy in that episode.
And, of course, we get Picard being a meerkat. Like, what direction did Gates McFadden give him for that? Or was she like, look, Patrick, do whatever. Like, what animal do you want to be? So like, I want to be a meerkat.
Okay, Patrick. Patrick, you've had a few drinks, and... You realize that you had a few drinks, like, and you're on stage in a few minutes, so you're feeling really awkward about having had going on a stage to do Hamlet with no cuts, and you've had a few. There we go. Okay, go with that fear. Go with that fear.
Perfect. God, I know I suggested that, and then it's a difficult thing. Going, oh, okay, both of them are fairly flawed. But entertaining.
So is this up or... Are we going up or down?
I don't know. I'm remembering the Barclay spider, and that's great. But also you get things like the kind of Troy just stuck in the bath getting aquatic.
And Spot turning into a lizard.
Spock turning into a lizard?
Spot, because
yes.
Data's cat turns into a lizard. And they're like, I don't think that's how it works.
So I thought you said Spock, and I was remembering some, like, missing some kind of threshold but original series.
I don't know. We still have, like, 2.5 seasons of Strange New World left. So true. Maybe Spock will become a lizard.
Maybe. They're doing a puppet episode, after all.
Oh, God, don't get me started on the puppet episode.
Oh, man, if you've got 20 episodes,
yeah,
fine.
I mean, okay.
Do a musical episode.
I mean, okay, like, got, like, we're 10. Doing it, okay, it's like... okay, guys, Angel was 20 years ago now. We should not be copying the beats of the weird episodes of Angel.
Okay, observation effect. Just below Genesis, Reed and Mayweather get possessed by cosmic entities, you know, as you do, who are observing the crew and then jumping from person to person.
Man, like, even down at 83, this was a good one.
It was a good Enterprise. They do exist, guys. They do. We can confirm. Okay, yeah.
The Enterprise episode, the Enterprise incident at number 84. Kirk tries to do a Metal Gear Solid and fails.
Yeah, and Spock pretends to defect and succeeds. I mean, the thing is, he's nicked the ship enough times. he's defected enough times. Like, you're gonna get good at you're gonna get practicing.
Yeah, and Spock gets his flirt on.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, God. Okay, I mean...
Would this episode have been saved after Gorner wearing, like, thigh-high boots? Like the Romulan commander?
Obviously. Obviously.
Would they be leather, though? Or crocodile skin? Like, what would the Gorn make clothes out of?
And would they be furry boots? Like Uggs?
Yes. Yes, the Gorn wear Ugg boots.
It's canon now.
The Gorn wear high-heeled Ugg boots.
Brilliant. Okay.
This is not the worst fashion disaster Star Trek has done.
That's very true. Yeah, the weird kind of knob hats weren't good. yeah, so... God, again, that's a difficult choice with Enterprise Incident. I think the Enterprise Incident's a little more sparse.
Yeah.
And not just by dint of being a single hour instead of a couple, but I think this is probably better for that. So I guess it does all of the Gorn genocide question kind of thing get in the way of the level of fun that... for the Enterprise Incident had.
Man.
Yeah, who would rank things on a big list?
Yeah.
Okay, actually, looking further down, we have Caves at 87.
Ooh.
Yeah. I think Caves is possibly better. It does a fun anthology episode. You got all kinds of freaky monsters.
Okay, I am looking down... Okay. Because there are some good ones here. Because we've got After Caves, we've got The Empath, we have Where Silence Has Lease, a whole bunch of Lower Decks. We have, at number 96, we have Hide in Q, where Riker gets Q powers and Wesley gets the point.
I think this is better than that.
Alright. So
like, that's pretty rough.
Okay, we have at number 94... we have Enterprise's Ceasefire, where Shran needs help from his BFF Archer. Like, I mean, Jeffrey Combs aside, Scott Bakula gets to do a little duck and roll.
He does. I think even though I love Jeffrey Combs in it, and I like the Andorians in general, I think this is probably better than Ceasefire.
Yeah. Even
with a little duck and roll.
All right, and then, okay, so above above Ceasefire, we have Lower Decks in number 93 with I, Excretus, where Boimler tries to platinum his Borg holodeck training program.
Oh, that's great fun. I guess it's that thing of 20-odd minutes of that versus almost 2 hours of this.
It's like Celeste said in our last episode, the Lower Decks episodes are just so densely packed with like gags really and jokes. Like, I'm just thinking about all the different holodeck programs that Mariner goes through and fails, ranging from Mirror Universe to trying to ride a horse and failing, to just two Boimler trying to platinum the Borg mission. And him getting more and more frustrated as he gets better and better.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen that behavior in my partner as she was trying to platinum things in
the line. I have a weak chest. I think assimilating me would actually be a net negative to the Borg.
Okay. So yeah, I think under I Excretus, yeah. So 94.
I mean, look, yeah, it's not like, it is not the bottom three episodes of the big list, which is 173, Star Trek Section 31, 172, Plato's Stepchildren, which is Amdram and Pratting About, and somehow much less morally reprehensible than Strange New Worlds is 172, Lift Us Where Suffering Cannot Reach, where it's a machine... powered by child death.
Yeah, I get the feeling. Now I'm at the start of three seasons in, there's definitely a lot less thinking about the implications of of the things they're doing. Like, I like Strange New Worlds. It's very good fun. But at the same time, you go like, ooh, oh dear. Like, is that really where you wanted to go with this?
Yeah, it's, I think my, like, Strange New Worlds, I have the same kind of issues with, that I've had with, like, the last couple of seasons of Doctor Who, which they are fine individually, but when you try and get some kind of through line of plot, story, or character, it kind of falls apart because it's clear. Yeah, I don't know. It's trying to do, trying to do 10 episodes of a space adventure show is a lot different from 22 episodes of a space adventure show. Because you can you have more space to just kind of experiment.
It's that thing of, they just need more room. They can be cheaper. It's fine. Like, you don't need to look like a film every week. In a way, I kind of would almost love to see if it was Strange New Worlds, but with the level of budget of Legends of Tomorrow. You know, which, again, did a lot in Canada, did a lot of very silly stuff and some serious stuff, and somehow managed to still be entertaining every week despite being just nonsense.
Or Stargate.
I mean, yeah.
Yeah.
Don't care as much about Stargate. But yes. Yeah. Anyway, speaking of nonsense, we've talked enough nonsense this week. So, next time, we're actually going to do Celeste's request. Sorry, Celeste, but, you know, Strange New Worlds was happening. Miles wanted an excuse to finally finish Season 2, and I'd been holding off on starting Season 3, so...
We are gonna try and find some episodes which heavily concern food.
Yeah, it's a challenge, but hopefully a fun one.
I mean, if worst comes to worst, we can always talk about the episode of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy TV show, where they go to Millieways, the restaurant at the end of the universe, where both David Prowse and Peter Davidson appear as a bodyguard and a cow, respectively.
God, I think that's one of the only episodes that I've seen of it. If you want to see more from us, obviously you can come here again in a fortnight. You can go to ko-fi.com/casualtrek and pay us literally anything, and we will do an episode of Casual Trek based around a theme of your choice. You can find us on casualtrek.bsky.social. And Miles, where can the good people find you?
They can find me at milesreadlabato.bsky.social for my Blue Sky account, or mareadlabato.wordpress.com for my occasionally updated blog.
Ooh.
And Charlie, where can the good folks of home find you, should they want to?
Should they want to, those sick deviants, they can find me on skyshark.itch.io. That's both the site where my RPG stuff is and my Blue Sky profile. Also, on Hey It's Skyshark on YouTube, I am currently doing RPG a day, or at least if this is still August, I'm doing RPG a day, which are a bunch of short, like, 5-minute videos based around a theme based around RPGs. And still in W.H. Smith's In Places Pulp Issue 1, which I'll also link to somewhere. Get it. It's got my story Past Futureman in it. He's a caveman, but he's in the future. Oh my god, shenanigans ensue. So yeah, and I hope this has been some good gornography for everyone.
My gorn.
So, go and do a Starfleet.
And just remember, each and every one of us was gorn free.
Hey. And, eat a jelly baby, maybe in a lizardy fashion.
So just kind of go, just kind of flick your tongue over and go.
I mean, I don't know any other way of doing it.
Or do your best Yoshi impression.
I mean, yeah.
And just kind of, meow. Oh, yeah. How's your Mario playthrough going?
I mean, I'm still on Sunshine.
Okay.
I can ride Yoshi in that, at least. now. So yeah.
Hooray.
Yeah, and hopefully he won't lay eggs in people.
I mean, that would be good, because Yoshi just lays eggs after eating like 6 or 7 Goombas or Koopa Troopas.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's not examine that too closely.
Given how fast Yoshi seems to digest food, that might be terrifying.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely terrifying. Okay. See ya.
Bye.
You have been listening to Casual Trek, a Nerd and Tie podcast, presented by Charlie Etheridge Nunn and Miles Reed Lobato. Music by Alfred Etheridge Nunn. Edited by the hosts and by Rihanna Reed Lobato. Star Trek is owned by Paramount. Not us. Not yet.